Chapter 23. 1. Damn girl. At first, Johnny had thought he had data on the point positions of the poles. He had no adequate viewing equipment in his house in Scotland. He had only taken a quick scan and a glance at a box Kerr had sent that seemed to have just a piece of cable in it. It was months to day 92, and so he was happy to stay for lunch and see Aunt Ellen and the parson again, and to try to cheer up Patty. He had flown back to the African mine site in good spirits. He had gotten up this morning all ready to really plow into it, and now this. Glencannon had said the delay was occasioned by Turl spending most of his time outside measuring. Turl apparently didn't like to stay outside very long. Glencannon hinted that a bit of air had been injected into breathe gas vials when the office was set up in order to discourage Turl from developing too much of a fondness for wandering around. Also, Glencannon had told him, they had omitted something in their original planning. They didn't have a picto recorder to record what went on around the platform itself. But they had rigged one in a tree now, and the Brigantes hadn't noticed, and they didn't have to depend on drone overflies anymore. Looking at them now, Johnny saw how meticulous Turl had been in measuring distances to poles. He had almost used a micrometer, but he had not been measuring point positions for teleportation firing. Here it was, the full layout and plan, complete with the exact dimensions. The firing platform, the new position for the console, and a squiggly line. Johnny knew now why Turl had spent so many days on force equations. He had been calculating exactly how close you could put the squiggly line to the firing platform without messing up the teleportation. There it was on his final plan. 7 8/11 feet. All around the firing platform and the new console. The box Kerr had sent contained a little note, written with his wrong paw, if Johnny knew Kerr. To you know who. Here is a chunk that got sawed off by accident. Ha ha. I am digging it up for them from beside that dam to the southwest, where it ain't used anymore. In case you don't know, it's called Atmosphere Armor Ionization Cable. I won't include the parts order number, because you won't be ordering any from Cyclo, ha ha. Also, it is a fine of 3 months' pay to give away company property, so if I am caught, you owe me another 3 months' pay. You're going to go broke at this rate, ha ha. You know who. Added, they are paying me a fortune to dig this up. You get your split when we swap lunch boxes, ha ha ha. Johnny inspected it. The cross-section was obviously the same as that around the dam and site in Kariba. But now he had a look at what it was composed of. It had to be put in right side up and be pointed in the direction you wanted the screen to go. It itself was armored, and how Kerr had cut it, he did not have any idea. The way it worked seemed fairly obvious. The bottom insulation interior was really a reflector. Just above that went the main current source. Then above that there was another wire, and above that a third, and so on up. A stack of 15 wires. Each apparently amplified the charge of the one just below it. Out at the end it must be fastened together with a box, not included here, which assisted amplification. The resulting fabulously boosted charge must be tuned to the fields of the core and ring particles of air atoms. Hit, the molecules of air realign themselves into molecular cohesion. The final product was an invisible curtain wall entitled Atmosphere Armor Ionization Cable. They had proved it at Kariba. Not even a bullet would go through it. It wasn't a force screen. Those were used in space, and the Hovens employed them on major war vessels. It was air armor. And Turl was going to put this 7 8/11 feet all around the console and platform? Johnny's tentative plan had been to let Turl build the console and set up the firing platform and then somehow seize it. But this changed things. How could one get through a solid curtain like that? Damn, Turl. Dully, Johnny made quite a few copies of the firing platform plan. He got out the Intergalactic Mining Company map of their one-time defenses and noted where CARE must be digging up cable for reinstallation at the platform. The map was so old and creased that he hadn't really noticed before that all mine sites had these cables around their dams and along their lines. He saw now that this African mine site had a second underground power transmission line, and that what had been known as the Owens Falls Dam back in man days was protected. He called for Angus and told him to go down there and check, and if the cable was still there, to get the trees removed from above it using a blade scraper, and then if the switchboard at the dam still worked, to shift over to underground transmission and drill the sentries on turning it on and off so one could get in and out of the dam and in and out of the mine site. Johnny, trying to work his way through this new one, wandered around the compound. He saw Sir Robert had just arrived and showed him on the old map that all the mine sites had these and that he should probably use them. Johnny wandered on, troubled. Teleportation, the secret of the Cyclos. With it, they had controlled universes. Without it, he didn't see how he could defend this one planet. He saw McKendrick. Yes, the wounded Cyclos were all well now. Except Chirk, who just lay there. No, he hadn't figured any way to get those things out of a Cyclo's head. Disturbance at that bone structure would kill the monster. Yes, he realized that if they tried to consult Cyclos on technical matters, they would attack and kill themselves. Or, if female, probably go into a coma like Chirk. What McKendrick was really worried about was the diet of the prisoners. The Cyclos in their manuals didn't consider it valuable information, being Cyclos. The prisoners themselves knew what they ate, but didn't know the names for it that applied to this planet, and if he didn't solve it, they'd shortly have no prisoners. Did Johnny know they now had 3 Jambit Chows? It was last night. Evidently a scouting party had been sent down to investigate all the new activity that was going on at Kariba. And the Scott officer there, the moment he got word a small craft had detached itself from the Jambit Chow cruiser up in orbit, had put into action something dreamed up by the Chinese. They called it a tiger net. They put a dummy dressed like a Chinese down near a pool away from the camp, and the Jambit Chows went right in to grab the dummy, and a big net had been tripped up in the trees, and they'd been caught. Evil-looking brutes. McKendrick wanted to know whether he'd heard what they ate. No? Well, the old woman from the mountains of the moon was helping, and maybe they could work it out. Johnny wandered on. Damn, Turl. It was getting too chancy. Somewhere, somehow, he should be able to get the information on some other channel. Once before, he had thought of exploring a teleportation motor to see whether he could get some sort of answer out of it. A motor wasn't a transshipment rig, but it did work on space position change. He had a motor and console to fool with, the ones from the wrecked tank in the Battle of the Pass. It had been carted in to the garage repair shop. Maybe if he just tore it apart, a thin hope, for he'd already looked at such rigs. But he got into some work clothes and went down to the repair level. The basher was sitting there, badly scarred and with a couple of plates sprung. He got into it, checked the fuel, and started the motor with a right here space coordination punched in on the console. It ran. One thing you could say about the Cyclos, their stuff lasted forever. He shut the motor off and took a screwdriver to the top screws of the console. He loosened them a half turn, each one. Johnny was distracted by a sentry appearing at the tank port and handing him some ear pads, asking him to put them on. Johnny stood up and looked out the turret port to find out what was going on. It was Stormalong and the Tallnep, Double Ensign Slivater Pliss, surrounded by guards. "What's up?" called Johnny. They didn't hear him. They all had ear pads on. Then Johnny saw that the Tallnep patrol craft had been dollied in here, and he could guess the rest of it. Stormalong probably wanted to know how it flew, so he could teach pilots how to handle Tallnep craft. Probably Angus wanted to know the cycles of vibration of that paralysis beam. Slivater Pliss seemed quite amiable. He had obviously written himself off as a tallnip. He saw Johnny and hissed a greeting. But if they were going to let the tallnip near that lethal sound vibrator, they were taking no chances that he would turn it on, paralyze the lot of them, and escape. Johnny didn't think so, for the tallnip had nowhere to go. But he put the ear pads on anyway. The tallnip seemed to find it a bit provoking that the accumulator terminals had been bent. They responded to his dumb show signs and gave him some tools, and he straightened them and re-hooked the power cable. The craft promptly began to run, and he shut it off. With more dumb show, he pointed the switches out to Stormalong, indicating what they connected to, and Stormalong seemed to find it quite elementary. He nodded to the tallnip and signaled the guards to take him away. Once Pliss was away from the craft, Johnny cautiously removed the ear pads and started to duck down out of the turret to resume his work. The tallnip alarmed the guards by pausing and swinging open the side door of the tank. He almost got himself shot. But Johnny gestured for them to back up. He could shove the screwdriver into the tallnip's teeth if he tried to bite.
"You people aren't cyclo-commanded, are you?" said the tallnip, hanging in the door.
Getting no answer, since Johnny was not going to volunteer information to a potential escapee, no matter how remote escape might be, the tallnip said,
"What are you trying to do with that tank motor?"
Johnny just looked at him for a moment, and then it occurred to him that as a tallnip officer, Pliss might have been trained on these things. "You know how this works?"
"Blast no, and neither does anyone else in any universe that I ever heard of," said Pliss. "We've never raided this planet, but we have raided other cyclo bases. According to the textbooks, we've brought in thousands of these things just for the experts to look at."
He smiled a rather frightening smile.
"I'll bet my next month's pay, which I'll never get, that you people are up against the same thing that everybody else is up against."
Allowing for possible malice, Johnny looked encouraging.
"We've gotten their textbooks, their mathematics texts even. We've actually captured a transshipment console intact. It said in the text that it worked once, and then as soon as they tried to find out how it was built, pop, no console. The very best tallnip commanders have interrogated cycloengineers,"
continued Pliss,
"and nothing happened. Some use that is. They chew you up and kill themselves. Been going on, I read once, for 302,000 years.
The tallnip changed the subject.
"You got a metal sample room around here? I'm hungry, and maybe I can find something."
Johnny told the guards to take him there.
"So good luck,"
said the tallnip, with a sarcastic-sounding hiss. They took him away. Possibly it was just malice, Johnny thought, but he didn't believe it. He'd lost track of the sequence of actions he had been involved in when he started all over again. He put the gear and tapped the power switch to start the tank motor. Nothing happened. He checked the connections. All usual. He tried to recall whether the tallnip had touched anything, and the tallnip hadn't. He once more tried to start the motor. Nothing. What had Kerr told him once about consoles? They'd had a blade machine back up. The canopy had been open because Johnny didn't need breathe gas, and a torrent of dirt had come spraying down on the console, and the blade machine wouldn't start afterward. Oh, yes. Kerr had said to leave it, that he'd get an engineer on it. Not a mechanic, but an engineer. And an engineer had come down and disconnected the console and taken it off to an underground workshop with a small traveling crane. Johnny had been more interested in the crane at the time. The cranes had magnetic plates in a circle with springs between them. They didn't have any motors. The arms of the crane moved by applying power to the magnets. Johnny wished he had watched when they pulled the console out. What had he done before the tallnip arrived? Let's see. He had loosened the top plate screws. Cyclos once in a while used screws. Most of the time, they just annealed metal with a molecular adhesion/cohesion blade, but they were a bit unusual. He now took all the screws out and lifted off the plate. The screws went into a black material that held, on its underside, all the complex components of the console. The screws. They must connect something to something in addition to holding the cover on. But he couldn't find any switch. They just seemed to be screws. But turning one or another of them had certainly disabled this console. He put it back together. He looked at another console and found the angle the screws were supposed to be set at. He set the Basher's console screws at the same angle. It would not start again, no matter what he did. It must be the screws. When that blade scraper quit, maybe a dirt clod had hit a screw and turned it. He went through all the motions for the fifth time, trying to align screws. But that was it. He had a dead motor Basher tank. Johnny finally gave it up. He went down to the lake and threw rocks at the crocodiles. Then he became ashamed of himself for teasing the beasts. They were very amiable creatures compared to Turl. A tri-wheeler came down from Sir Robert who wanted to tell Johnny it was unwise to be in the open without air cover. The visitors might send somebody down. "Would you like to shoot a cyclo?" Johnny asked a startled messenger. "Damn, Turl. Damn all cyclos." And it wasn't any comfort to know that thousands of races had been saying the same thing for 302,000 years. He'd have to think of something, some plan, no matter how desperate or dangerous, or this planet was finished. 2. Winter had come to Denver, but the cold wind and snow flurries could not dampen the elation of Brown Limper Staffer. The banknote had arrived. A packet of them lay on his desk, and four of them were spread out before him. How beautiful! They were bright yellow, printed on one side, and there, right in the middle, was an oval picture of Brown Limper. What an awful lot of trouble they had had getting that picture. Brown Limper had tried innumerable poses, facing this way and that. He had tried countless expressions, frowning or scowling, but none of these would do. Lars Thorensen had finally had to give him a hand. Lars had explained that it was the beard that was wrong. Brown Limper had a black mustache and beard, and whereas the mustache was all right, the beard was thin and scraggly. So the thing to do was shave off the beard and trim the mustache until it was a bushy tuft just under the nose. That was the sort of mustache the great military hero Hitler had had, and so it must be correct. Then there had been the problem of a proper costume. Nobody seemed to find anything proper. General Smith came to the rescue. He had heard one of his men report that there was an old graveyard that had air-sealed coffins in it. Several had been dug up, looking for a corpse that had been properly dressed. But after more than 1,000 years, the fabric wouldn't hold together. The only outcome of all that was a sickness that had hit the Brigantes. Two had died, and a doctor, passing through, had said it was formaldehyde poisoning, whatever that was. Somebody had finally found a bolt of gray cloth in a basement that didn't tear very much, and somebody else had found a pattern that said chauffeur's uniform on it, and some Brigante women had sewn it up. They had also found a black visored cap that lasted long enough for the picture. Smith had a handful of jewelry he'd found, which Brown Limper knew couldn't possibly be rubies or diamonds and was probably colored glass, and they'd put that on the left breast of the coat so he would have medals. The final posing was solved by using a picture Lars had of somebody called Napoleon, also a great military hero of ancient man. The pose had the fingers of one hand tucked into the coat edge on the breast. McAdam had been a bit difficult. He had asked Brown Limper whether this was what he really wanted by way of a portrait, and Brown Limper had been cross about it. After all that trouble, of course that was what he wanted. So, here was the new banknote at last. It was a 100-credit note. McAdam had said he could only print one denomination, and it had to be 100 credits. Brown Limper realized that that made this a far more important bill. It had the bank name on it, It was only printed in English and no other tribal language. And right there, loud and clear, it said, 100 American credits. And it said, valid for the payment of public and private debts in America. One of the conditions McAdam had made was that all earlier money in the country be collected up and exchanged for these new bills. It was hard to do because the earlier issue was a one-credit banknote, and this American issue was a 100-credit banknote. But the dream of having all Tyler notes gone was so alluring, Brown Limper had made up the differences in exchange out of his own pocket. This victory was doing much to improve Brown Limper's spirits. They had been very low as of late. When that Tyler had not only not gone to his booby-trapped home in the meadow, but had walked right out of the country, Brown Limper had been so dispirited he had wanted to call off the whole Turl project. But Lars had talked to him. Lars seemed to have developed a hatred for Tyler. He did not say it was from the degradation of hiding under scrap metal in the garage and envy over the way Tyler could fly, but the emotion was very well understood by Brown Limper, who considered it natural. Lars had said that if they went ahead and actually transshipped, Tyler was certain to reappear. Turl had talked to him. Turl said that when they fired a shipment to Cyclo, Tyler would be right there, and he had traps for him that even Tyler could not get around. So Brown Limper had continued with the project. Other things were going wrong, though. He did not hear much anymore from the tribal chiefs. Lars explained it was natural. They trusted him to run things. No pilgrims came anymore to the mine site. But that was natural. It was winter. People had been disappearing.